During this halt, the escort treated the prisoners even worse than they had done at the start. It was here that the prisoners for the first time received horse flesh for their meat ration. From the officer down to the lowest soldier, they all showed what seemed like personal spite against each of the prisoners, in unexpected contrast to their former friendly relations. This spite increased still more when, on calling over the roll of prisoners, it was found that in the bustle of leaving Moscow, one Russian soldier who had pretended to suffer from colic had escaped. Pierre saw a Frenchman beat a Russian soldier cruelly for straying too far from the road, and heard his friend the captain reprimand and threaten to court-martial a non-commissioned officer on account of the escape of the Russian. To the non-commissioned officer's excuse that the prisoner was ill and could not walk, the officer replied that the order was to shoot those who lagged behind. Pierre felt that that fatal force which had crushed him during the executions, but which he had not felt during his imprisonment, now again controlled his existence. It was terrible, but he felt that in proportion to the efforts of that fatal force to crush him, there grew and strengthened in his soul a power of life independent of it. He ate his supper of buckwheat soup with horseflesh and chatted with his comrades. Neither Pierre nor any of the others spoke of what they had seen in Moscow, or of the roughness of their treatment by the French, or of the order to shoot them, which had been announced to them. As if in reaction against the worsening of their position, they were all particularly animated and gay. They spoke of personal reminiscences, of amusing scenes they had witnessed during the campaign, and avoided all talk of their present situation. The sun had set long since. Bright stars shone out here and there in the sky. A red glow as of a conflagration spread above the horizon from the rising full moon, and that vast red ball swayed strangely in the gray haze. It grew light. The evening was ending, but the night had not yet come. Pierre got up and left his new companions, crossing between the campfires to the other side of the road, where he had been told the common soldier prisoners were stationed. He wanted to talk to them. On the road, he was stopped by a French sentinel who ordered him back. Pierre turned back, not to his companions by the campfire, but to an unharnessed cart where there was nobody. Tucking his legs under him and dropping his head, he sat down on the cold ground by the wheel of the cart and remained motionless a long while, sunk in thought. Suddenly, he burst out into a fit of his broad, good-natured laughter, so loud that men from various sides turned with surprise to see what this strange and evidently solitary laughter could mean. "Ha, ha, ha, ha," laughed Pierre, and he said aloud to himself, "The soldier did not let me pass. They took me and shut me up. They hold me captive. What, me? Me? My immortal soul? Ha, 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 ha." And he laughed till tears started to his eyes. A man got up and came to see what this queer big fellow was laughing at all by himself. Pierre stopped laughing, got up, went farther away from the inquisitive man, and looked around him. The huge, endless bivouac that had previously resounded with the crackling of campfires and the voices of many men had grown quiet. The red campfires were growing paler and dying down. High up in the light sky hung the full moon. Forests and fields beyond the camp, unseen before, were now visible in the distance. And farther still, beyond those forests and fields, the bright, oscillating, limitless distance lured one to itself. Pierre glanced up at the sky and the twinkling stars in its faraway depths. "And all that is me. All that is within me. And it is all I," thought Pierre. "And they caught all that and put it into a shed boarded up with planks." He smiled and went and lay down to sleep beside his companions. Chapter 4. The Russian Army. Dokhturov. News of the French having left Moscow reaches Kutuzov at night. His emotion. Cossacks nearly capture Napoleon at Maloyaroslavets. he retreats by the Smolensk road. A third of his army melts away before reaching Vyazma. In the early days of October, another envoy came to Kutuzov with a letter from Napoleon proposing peace and falsely dated from Moscow, though Napoleon was already not far from Kutuzov on the old Kaluga road. Kutuzov replied to this letter as he had done to the one formerly brought by Lauriston, saying that there could be no question of peace. Soon after that, a report was received from Dorohov's guerrilla detachment operating to the left of Tarutino that troops of Broussier's division had been seen at Forminsk, and that being separated from the rest of the French army, they might easily be destroyed. The soldiers and officers again demanded action. Generals on the staff, excited by the memory of the easy victory at Tarutino, urged Kutuzov to carry out Dorohov's suggestion. Kutuzov did not consider any offensive necessary. The result was a compromise which was inevitable. A small detachment was sent to Forminsk to attack Broussier. By a strange coincidence, this task, which turned out to be a most difficult and important one, was entrusted to Dokhturov, that same modest little Dokhturov whom no one had described to us as drawing up plans of battles, dashing about in front of regiments, showering crosses on batteries, and so on, and who was thought to be and was spoken of as undecided and undiscerning, but whom we find commanding wherever the position was most difficult all through the Russian-French wars from Austerlitz to the year 1813. At Austerlitz, he remained last at the Augetz Dam, rallying the regiments, saving what was possible when all were flying and perishing and not a single general was left in the rear guard. Ill with fever, he went to Smolensk with 20,000 men to defend the town against Napoleon's whole army. In Smolensk, at the Malakhov Gate, he had hardly dozed off in a paroxysm of fever before he was awakened by the bombardment of the town. And Smolensk held out all day long. At the Battle of Borodino, when Bagration was killed and 9/10 of the men of our left flank had fallen and the full force of the French artillery fire was directed against it, the man sent there was this same irresolute and undiscerning Dokhturov, Kutuzov hastening to rectify a mistake he had made by sending someone else there first. And the quiet little Dokhturov rode thither, and Borodino became the greatest glory of the Russian army. Many heroes have been described to us in verse and prose, but of Dokhturov scarcely a word has been said. It was Dokhturov again whom they sent to Forminsk, and from there to Maloyaroslavets, the place where the last battle with the French was fought and where the obvious disintegration of the French army began. And we are told of many geniuses and heroes of that period of the campaign, but of Dokhturov nothing or very little is said, and that dubiously. And this silence about Dokhturov is the clearest testimony to his merit. It is natural for a man who does not understand the workings of a machine to imagine that a shaving that has fallen into it by chance and is interfering with its action and tossing about in it is its most important part. The man who does not understand the construction of the machine cannot conceive that the small connecting cog wheel, which revolves quietly, is one of the most essential parts of the machine, and not the shaving, which merely harms and hinders the working. On the 10th of October, when Dokhturov had gone halfway to Forminsk and stopped at the village of Aristovo, preparing faithfully to execute the orders he had received, the whole French army, having in its convulsive movement reached Murat's position, apparently in order to give battle, suddenly, without any reason, turned off to the left onto the new Kaluga road and began to enter Forminsk, where only Broussier had been till then. At that time, Dokhturov had under his command, besides Dorohov's detachment, the two small guerrilla detachments of Figner and Seslavin. On the evening of October 11th, Seslavin came to the Aristovo headquarters with a French guardsman he had captured. The prisoner said that the troops that had entered Forminsk that day were the vanguard of the whole army, that Napoleon was there, and the whole army had left Moscow 4 days previously. That same evening, a house serf who had come from Borovsk said he had seen an immense army entering the town. some Cossacks of Dokhturov's detachment reported having sighted the French guards marching along the road to Borovsk. From all these reports, it was evident that where they had expected to meet a single division, there was now the whole French army marching from Moscow in an unexpected direction, along the Kaluga road. Dokhturov was unwilling to undertake any action, as it was not clear to him now what he ought to do. He had been ordered to attack Forminsk, but only Broussier had been there at that time, and now the whole French army was there. Yermolov wished to act on his own judgment, but Dokhturov insisted that he must have Kutuzov's instructions. So it was decided to send a dispatch to the staff. For this purpose, a capable officer, Bolkhovitinov, was chosen, who was to explain the whole affair by word of mouth, besides delivering a written report. Toward midnight, Bolkhovitinov, having received the dispatch and verbal instructions, galloped off to the general staff, accompanied by a Cossack with spare horses. It was a warm, dark autumn night. It had been raining for 4 days. Having changed horses twice and galloped 20 miles in an hour and a half over a sticky, muddy road, Bolkhovitinov reached Litashovka after 1 o'clock at night. Dismounting at a cottage on whose wattle fence hung a signboard "General Staff," and throwing down his reins, he entered a dark passage. "The general on duty, quick. It's very important," said he to someone who had risen and was sniffing in the dark passage. "He's been very unwell since the evening, and this is the third night he's not slept," said the orderly pleadingly in a whisper. "You should wake the captain first." "But this is very important, from General Dokhturov," said Bolkhovitinov, entering the open door which he had found by feeling in the dark. The orderly had gone in before him and began waking somebody.
"Your Honor, Your Honor, a courier."
"What?
What's that? From whom?"
came a sleepy voice. "From Dokhturov and from Alexei Petrovich. Napoleon is at Forminsk," said Bolkhovitinov, unable to see in the dark who was speaking, but guessing by the voice that it was not Konovnitsyn. The man who had wakened yawned and stretched himself.
"I don't like waking him," he said, fumbling for something. "He's very ill. Perhaps this is only a rumor."
"Here's the dispatch," said Bolkhovitinov. "My orders are to give it at once to the general on duty."
"Wait a moment, I'll light a candle." "You damn rascal, where do you always hide it?" said the voice of the man who was stretching himself to the orderly.
This was Shcherbinin, Konovnitsyn's adjutant.
I've found it, he added.
The orderly was striking a light, and Shcherbinin was fumbling for something on the candlestick.
"All the nasty beasts," said he with disgust.
By the light of the sparks, Bolkhovitinov saw Shcherbinin's youthful face as he held the candle, and the face of another man who was still asleep. This was Konovnitsyn. When the flame of the sulphur splinters kindled by the tinder burned up, first blue and then red, Shcherbinin lit the tallow candle, from the candlestick of which the cockroaches that had been gnawing it were running away, and looked at the messenger. Bolkhovitinov was bespattered all over with mud, and had smeared his face by wiping it with his sleeve. "Who gave the report?" inquired Shcherbinin, taking the envelope. "The news is reliable," said Bolkhovitinov. "Prisoners, Cossacks, and the scouts all say the same thing."
"There's nothing to be done. We'll have to wake him," said Shcherbinin,
rising and going up to the man in the nightcap who lay covered by a greatcoat.
"Peter Petrovich," said he.
Konovnitsyn did not stir. "To the general staff," he said with a smile, knowing that those words would be sure to arouse him. And, in fact, the head in the nightcap was lifted at once. On Konovnitsyn's handsome, resolute face, with cheeks flushed by fever, there still remained for an instant a far-away, dreamy expression, remote from present affairs. But then he suddenly started, and his face assumed its habitual calm and firm appearance. "Well, what is it?" "From whom?" he asked immediately, but without hurry, blinking at the light. While listening to the officer's report, Konovnitsyn broke the seal and read the dispatch. Hardly had he done so before he lowered his legs in their woolen stockings to the earthen floor and began putting on his boots. Then he took off his nightcap, combed his hair over his temples, and donned his cap. "Did you get here quickly? Let us go to His Highness." Konovnitsyn had understood at once that the news brought was of great importance and that no time must be lost. He did not consider or ask himself whether the news was good or bad. That did not interest him. He regarded the whole business of the war not with his intelligence or his reason, but by something else. There was within him a deep, unexpressed conviction that all would be well, but that one must not trust to this, and still less speak about it, but must only attend to one's own work. And he did his work, giving his whole strength to the task. Peter Petrovich Konovnitsyn, like Dokhturov, seems to have been included merely for propriety's sake in the list of the so-called heroes of 1812, the Barclays, Raevskis, Yermolovs, Platovs, and Miloradoviches. Like Dokhturov, he had the reputation of being a man of very limited capacity and information, and like Dokhturov, he never made plans of battle, but was always found where the situation was most difficult. Since his appointment as general on duty, he had always slept with his door open, giving orders that every messenger should be allowed to wake him up. In battle, he was always under fire, so that Kutuzov reproved him for it and feared to send him to the front. And like Dokhturov, he was one of those unnoticed cogwheels that, without clatter or noise, constitute the most essential part of the machine. Coming out of the hut into the damp, dark night, Konovnitsyn frowned, partly from an increased pain in his head and partly at the unpleasant thought that occurred to him of how all that nest of influential men on the staff would be stirred up by his news, especially Bennigsen, who, ever since Tarutino, had been at daggers drawn with Kutuzov, and how they would make suggestions, quarrel, issue orders, and rescind them. And this premonition was disagreeable to him, though he knew it could not be helped. And in fact, Toll, to whom he went to communicate the news, immediately began to expound his plans to a general sharing his quarters, until Konovnitsyn, who listened in weary silence, reminded him that they must go to see His Highness. Kutuzov, like all old people, did not sleep much at night. He often fell asleep unexpectedly in the daytime, but at night, lying on his bed without undressing, he generally remained awake, thinking. So he lay now on his bed, supporting his large, heavy, scarred head on his plump hand, with his one eye open, meditating, and peering into the darkness. Since Bennigsen, who corresponded with the Emperor and had more influence than anyone else on the staff, had begun to avoid him, Kutuzov was more at ease as to the possibility of himself and his troops being obliged to take part in useless, aggressive movements. The lesson of the Tarutino battle, and of the day before it, which Kutuzov remembered with pain, must, he thought, have some effect on others, too. They must understand that we can only lose by taking the offensive. Patience and time are my warriors, my champions, thought Kutuzov. He knew that an apple should not be plucked while it is green. It will fall of itself when ripe, but if picked unripe, the apple is spoiled, the tree is harmed, and your teeth are set on edge. Like an experienced sportsman, he knew that the beast was wounded, and wounded as only the whole strength of Russia could have wounded it, but whether it was mortally wounded or not was still an undecided question. Now, by the fact of Lauriston and Barthélemy having been sent, and by the reports of the guerrillas, Kutuzov was almost sure that the wound was mortal. But he needed further proofs, and it was necessary to wait. They want to run to see how they have wounded it. Wait, and we shall see. Continual maneuvers, continual advances, thought he. What for? Only to distinguish themselves, as if fighting were fun. They're like children from whom one can't get any sensible account of what has happened because they all want to show how well they can fight. But that's not what is needed now. And what ingenious maneuvers they all proposed to me. It seems to them that when they have thought of two or three contingencies, he remembered the general plan sent him from Petersburg, they have foreseen everything, but the contingencies are endless. The undecided question as to whether the wound inflicted at Borodino was mortal or not had hung over Kutuzov's head for a whole month. On the one hand, the French had occupied Moscow. On the other, Kutuzov felt assured with all his being that the terrible blow into which he and all the Russians had put their whole strength must have been mortal. But in any case, proofs were needed. He had waited a whole month for them and grew more impatient the longer he waited. Lying on his bed during those sleepless nights, he did just what he reproached those younger generals for doing. He imagined all sorts of possible contingencies, just like the younger men. But with this difference, that he saw thousands of contingencies instead of two or three, and based nothing on them. The longer he thought, the more contingencies presented themselves. He imagined all sorts of movements of the Napoleonic army as a whole or in sections, against Petersburg, or against him, or to outflank him. He thought, too, of the possibility, which he feared most of all, that Napoleon might fight him with his own weapon and remain in Moscow awaiting him. Kutuzov even imagined that Napoleon's army might turn back through Medin and Yukhnov. But the one thing he could not foresee was what happened. The insane, convulsive stampede of Napoleon's army during its first 11 days after leaving Moscow, a stampede which made possible what Kutuzov had not yet even dared to think of, the complete extermination of the French. Dorohoff's report about Broussier's division, the guerrillas' reports of distress in Napoleon's army, rumors of preparations for leaving Moscow, all confirmed the supposition that the French army was beaten and preparing for flight. But these were only suppositions, which seemed important to the younger men, but not to Kutuzov. With his 60 years' experience, he knew what value to attach to rumors, knew how apt people who desire anything are to group all news so that it appears to confirm what they desire. And he knew how readily in such cases they omit all that makes for the contrary. And the more he desired it, the less he allowed himself to believe it. This question absorbed all his mental powers. All else was to him only life's customary routine. To such customary routine belonged his conversations with the staff, the letters he wrote from Tarutino to Madame de Stael, the reading of novels, the distribution of awards, his correspondence with Petersburg, and so on. But the destruction of the French, which he alone foresaw, was his heart's one desire. On the night of the 11th of October, he lay leaning on his arm and thinking of that. There was a stir in the next room, and he heard the steps of Tol, Konovnitsyn, and Bolkhovitinov.
Eh? Who's there? Come in, come in. What news?
The field marshal called out to them. While a footman was lighting a candle, Tol communicated the substance of the news.
Who brought it?
Asked Kutuzov, with a look which, when the candle was lit, struck Tol by its cold severity.
There can be no doubt about it, Your Highness. Call him in, call him here.
Kutuzov sat up with one leg hanging down from the bed and his big paunch resting against the other, which was doubled under him. He screwed up his seeing eye to scrutinize the messenger more carefully, as if wishing to read in his face what preoccupied his own mind.
Tell me, friend, said he to Bolkhovitinov in his low, aged voice, as he pulled together the shirt which gaped open on his chest. Come nearer, nearer. What news have you brought me, eh? That Napoleon has left Moscow? Are you sure, eh?
Bolkhovitinov gave a detailed account from the beginning of all he had been told to report.
Speak quicker, quicker. Don't torture me, Kutuzov interrupted him.
Bolkhovitinov told him everything and was then silent, awaiting instructions. Tol was beginning to say something, but Kutuzov checked him. He tried to say something, but his face suddenly puckered and wrinkled. He waved his arm at Tol and turned to the opposite side of the room, to the corner darkened by the icons that hung there.
O Lord, my Creator, thou hast heard our prayer, said he in a tremulous voice with folded hands. Russia is saved. I thank thee, O Lord.
And he wept. From the time he received this news to the end of the campaign, all Kutuzov's activity was directed toward restraining his troops, by authority, by guile, and by entreaty, from useless attacks, maneuvers, or encounters with the perishing enemy. Dokhturov went to Maloyaroslavets, but Kutuzov lingered with the main army and gave orders for the evacuation of Kaluga, a retreat beyond which town seemed to him quite possible. Everywhere Kutuzov retreated, but the enemy, without waiting for his retreat, fled in the opposite direction. Napoleon's historians describe to us his skilled maneuvers at Tarutino and Malo Yaroslavets, and make conjectures as to what would have happened had Napoleon been in time to penetrate into the rich southern provinces. But not to speak of the fact that nothing prevented him from advancing into those southern provinces, for the Russian army did not bar his way, the historians forget that nothing could have saved his army, for then already it bore within itself the germs of inevitable ruin. How could that army, which had found abundant supplies in Moscow and had trampled them underfoot instead of keeping them, and on arriving at Smolensk had looted provisions instead of storing them, how could that army recuperate in Kaluga province, which was inhabited by Russians such as those who lived in Moscow, and where fire had the same property of consuming what was set ablaze? That army could not recover anywhere. Since the Battle of Borodino and the pillage of Moscow, it had borne within itself, as it were, the chemical elements of dissolution. The members of what had once been an army, Napoleon himself and all his soldiers, fled without knowing whither, each concerned only to make his escape as quickly as possible from this position, of the hopelessness of which they were all more or less vaguely conscious. So it came about that at the council at Malo Yaroslavets, when the generals pretending to confer together expressed various opinions, all mouths were closed by the opinion uttered by the simple-minded soldier Mouton, who, speaking last, said what they all felt, that the one thing needful was to get away as quickly as possible, and no one, not even Napoleon, could say anything against that truth which they all recognized. But though they all realized that it was necessary to get away, there still remained a feeling of shame at admitting that they must flee. An external shock was needed to overcome that shame, and this shock came in due time. It was what the French called le hurrah de l'empereur. The day after the council at Malo Yaroslavets, Napoleon rode out early in the morning amid the lines of his army with his suite of marshals and an escort, on the pretext of inspecting the army and the scene of the previous and of the impending battle. Some Cossacks on the prowl for booty fell in with the emperor and very nearly captured him. If the Cossacks did not capture Napoleon then, what saved him was the very thing that was destroying the French army, the booty on which the Cossacks fell. Here, as at Tarutino, they went after plunder, leaving the men. Disregarding Napoleon, they rushed after the plunder, and Napoleon managed to escape. When les enfants du Don, the children of the Don, might so easily have taken the emperor himself in the midst of his army, it was clear that there was nothing for it but to fly as fast as possible along the nearest familiar road. Napoleon, with his 40-year-old stomach, understood that hint, not feeling his former agility and boldness, and under the influence of the fright the Cossacks had given him, he at once agreed with Mouton and issued orders, as the historians tell us, to retreat by the Smolensk road. That Napoleon agreed with Mouton, and that the army retreated, does not prove that Napoleon caused it to retreat, but that the forces which influenced the whole army and directed it along the Mozhaisk, that is, the Smolensk road, acted simultaneously on him also. A man in motion always devises an aim for that motion. To be able to go 1,000 miles, he must imagine that something good awaits him at the end of those 1,000 miles. One must have the prospect of a promised land to have the strength to move. The promised land for the French during their advance had been Moscow. During their retreat, it was their native land. But that native land was too far off, and for a man going 1,000 miles, it is absolutely necessary to set aside his final goal and to say to himself, "Today I shall get to a place 25 miles off, where I shall rest and spend the night." And during the first day's journey, that resting place eclipses his ultimate goal and attracts all his hopes and desires. And the impulses felt by a single person are always magnified in a crowd. For the French retreating along the old Smolensk road, the final goal their native land, was too remote, and their immediate goal was Smolensk, toward which all their desires and hopes, enormously intensified in the mass, urged them on. It was not that they knew that much food and fresh troops awaited them in Smolensk, nor that they were told so. On the contrary, their superior officers and Napoleon himself knew that provisions were scarce there. But because this alone could give them strength to move on and endure their present privations. So both those who knew and those who did not know deceived themselves and pushed on to Smolensk as to a promised land. Coming out onto the high road, the French fled with surprising energy and unheard-of rapidity toward the goal they had fixed on. Besides the common impulse, which bound the whole crowd of French into one mass and supplied them with a certain energy, there was another cause binding them together, their great numbers. As with the physical law of gravity, their enormous mass drew the individual human atoms to itself. In their hundreds of thousands, they moved like a whole nation. Each of them desired nothing more than to give himself up as a prisoner to escape from all this horror and misery. But on the one hand, the force of this common attraction to Smolensk, their goal, drew each of them in the same direction. On the other hand, an army corps could not surrender to a company. And though the French availed themselves of every convenient opportunity to detach themselves and to surrender on the slightest decent pretext, such pretexts did not always occur. Their very numbers and their crowded and swift movement deprived them of that possibility and rendered it not only difficult but impossible for the Russians to stop this movement to which the French were directing all their energies. Beyond a certain limit, no mechanical disruption of the body could hasten the process of decomposition. A lump of snow cannot be melted instantaneously. There is a certain limit of time in less than which no amount of heat can melt the snow. On the contrary, the greater the heat, the more solidified the remaining snow becomes. Of the Russian commanders, Kutuzov alone understood this. When the flight of the French army along the Smolensk road became well defined, what Konovnitsyn had foreseen on the night of the 11th of October began to occur. The superior officers all wanted to distinguish themselves, to cut off, to seize, to capture, and to overthrow the French, and all clamored for action. Kutuzov alone used all his power, and such power is very limited in the case of any commander-in-chief, to prevent an attack. He could not tell them what we say now. Why fight? Why block the road, losing our own men and inhumanly slaughtering unfortunate wretches? What is the use of that when a third of their army has melted away on the road from Moscow to Vyazma without any battle? But drawing from his aged wisdom what they could understand, he told them of the Golden Bridge, and they laughed at and slandered him, flinging themselves on, rending and exulting over the dying beast. Yermolov, Miloradovich, Platov, and others in proximity to the French near Vyazma could not resist their desire to cut off and break up two French corps, and by way of reporting their intention to Kutuzov, they sent him a blank sheet of paper in an envelope. And try as Kutuzov might to restrain the troops, our men attacked, trying to bar the road. Infantry regiments, we are told, advanced to the attack with music and with drums beating, and killed and lost thousands of men. But they did not cut off or overthrow anybody, and the French army, closing up more firmly at the danger, continued, while steadily melting away, to pursue its fatal path to Smolensk. Book 14. Date of principal historical event. 1812, old style, October 28th to November 2nd, the French at Smolensk. Chapter 1. National character of the war. A duelist who drops his rapier and seizes a cudgel. Guerrilla warfare. The spirit of the army. The Battle of Borodino, with the occupation of Moscow that followed it, and the flight of the French without further conflicts, is one of the most instructive phenomena in history. All historians agree that the external activity of states and nations in their conflicts with one another is expressed in wars, and that as a direct result of greater or less success in war, the political strength of states and nations increases or decreases. Strange as may be the historical account of how some king or emperor, having quarreled with another, collects an army, fights his enemy's army, gains a victory by killing 3, 5, or 10,000 men, and subjugates a kingdom and an entire nation of several millions. All the facts of history, as far as we know it, confirm the truth of the statement that the greater or lesser success of one army against another is the cause, or at least an essential indication, of an increase or decrease in the strength of the nation, even though it is unintelligible why the defeat of an army, a hundredth part of a nation, should oblige that whole nation to submit. An army gains a victory, and at once the rights of the conquering nation have increased to the detriment of the defeated. An army has suffered defeat, and at once a people loses its rights in proportion to the severity of the reverse. And if its army suffers a complete defeat, the nation is quite subjugated. So, according to history, it has been found from the most ancient times. And so it is to our own day. All Napoleon's wars serve to confirm this rule. In proportion to the defeat of the Austrian army, Austria loses its rights, and the rights and the strength of France increase. The victories of the French at Jena and Auerstedt destroy the independent existence of Prussia. But then, in 1812, the French gain a victory near Moscow. Moscow is taken, and after that, with no further battles, it is not Russia that ceases to exist, but the French army of 600,000. And then Napoleonic France itself. To strain the facts to fit the rules of history, to say that the field of battle at Borodino remained in the hands of the Russians, or that after Moscow there were other battles that destroyed Napoleon's army, is impossible. After the French victory at Borodino, there was no general engagement, nor any that were at all serious. Yet the French army ceased to exist. What does this mean? If it were an example taken from the history of China, we might say that it was not an historic phenomenon, which is the historian's usual expedient when anything does not fit their standards. If the matter concerned some brief conflict in which only a small number of troops took part, we might treat it as an exception. But this event occurred before our fathers' eyes, and for them it was a question of the life or death of their fatherland, and it happened in the greatest of all known wars. The period of the campaign of 1812, from the Battle of Borodino to the expulsion of the French, proved that the winning of a battle does not produce a conquest, and is not even an invariable indication of conquest. It proved that the force which decides the fate of peoples lies not in the conquerors, nor even in armies and battles, but in something else. The French historians, describing the condition of the French army before it left Moscow, affirm that all was in order in the Grand Army, except the cavalry, the artillery, and the transport. There was no forage for the horses or the cattle. That was a misfortune no one could remedy, for the peasants of the district burned their hay rather than let the French have it. The victory gained did not bring the usual results, because the peasants, Karp and Vlas, who after the French had evacuated Moscow drove in their carts to pillage the town and in general personally failed to manifest any heroic feelings, and the whole innumerable multitude of such peasants did not bring their hay to Moscow for the high price offered them, but burned it instead. Let us imagine two men who have come out to fight a duel with rapiers according to all the rules of the art of fencing. The fencing has gone on for some time. Suddenly, one of the combatants, feeling himself wounded,
and understanding that the matter is no joke, but concerns his life, throws down his rapier, and seizing the first cudgel that comes to hand, begins to brandish it. Then let us imagine that the combatant who so sensibly employed the best and simplest means to attain his end was at the same time influenced by traditions of chivalry, and desiring to conceal the facts of the case, insisted that he had gained his victory with the rapier, according to all the rules of art. One can imagine what confusion and obscurity would result from such an account of the duel. The fencer who demanded a contest according to the rules of fencing was the French army. His opponent, who threw away the rapier and snatched up the cudgel, was the Russian people. Those who try to explain the matter according to the rules of fencing are the historians who have described the event. After the burning of Smolensk, a war began which did not follow any previous traditions of war. The burning of towns and villages, the retreats after battles, the blow dealt at Borodino and the renewed retreat, the burning of Moscow, the capture of marauders, the seizure of transports, and the guerrilla war were all departures from the rules. Napoleon felt this, and from the time he took up the correct fencing attitude in Moscow, and instead of his opponent's rapier saw a cudgel raised above his head, he did not cease to complain to Kutuzov and to the Emperor Alexander that the war was being carried on contrary to all the rules. As if there were any rules for killing people. In spite of the complaints of the French as to the non-observance of the rules, in spite of the fact that to some highly placed Russians it seemed rather disgraceful to fight with a cudgel and they wanted to assume a pose en carte or en tierce according to all the rules, and to make an adroit thrust en prime and so on, the cudgel of the people's war was lifted with all its menacing and majestic strength, and without consulting anyone's tastes or rules, and regardless of anything else, it rose and fell with stupid simplicity, but consistently, and belabored the French till the whole invasion had perished. And it is well for a people who do not, as the French did in 1813, salute according to all the rules of art, and presenting the hilt of their rapier gracefully and politely, hand it to their magnanimous conqueror. But at the moment of trial, without asking what rules others have adopted in similar cases, simply and easily pick up the first cudgel that comes to hand and strike with it till the feeling of resentment and revenge in their soul yields to a feeling of contempt and compassion. One of the most obvious and advantageous departures from the so-called laws of war is the action of scattered groups against men pressed together in a mass. Such action always occurs in wars that take on a national character. In such actions, instead of two crowds opposing each other, the men disperse, attack singly, run away when attacked by stronger forces, but again attack when opportunity offers. This was done by the guerrillas in Spain, by the mountain tribes in the Caucasus, and by the Russians in 1812. People have called this kind of war guerrilla warfare, and assumed that by so calling it they have explained its meaning. But such a war does not fit in under any rule and is directly opposed to a well-known rule of tactics which is accepted as infallible. That rule says that an attacker should concentrate his forces in order to be stronger than his opponent at the moment of conflict. Guerrilla war, always successful as history shows, directly infringes that rule. This contradiction arises from the fact that military science assumes the strength of an army to be identical with its numbers. Military science says that the more troops, the greater the strength. Les gros bataillons ont toujours raison. Large battalions are always victorious. For military science to say this is like defining momentum in mechanics by reference to the mass only, stating that momenta are equal or unequal to each other simply because the masses involved are equal or unequal. Momentum, quantity of motion, is the product of mass and velocity. In military affairs,
The strength of an army is the product of its mass and some unknown X. Military science, seeing in history innumerable instances of the fact that the size of an army does not coincide with its strength, and that small detachments defeat larger ones, obscurely admits the existence of this unknown factor and tries to discover it, now in a geometric formation, now in the equipment employed, now, and most usually, in the genius of the commanders. But the assignment of these various meanings to the factor does not yield results which accord with the historic facts. Yet it is only necessary to abandon the false view adopted to gratify the heroes of the efficacy of the directions issued in wartime by commanders in order to find this unknown quantity. That unknown quantity is the spirit of the army. That is to say, the greater or lesser readiness to fight and face danger felt by all the men composing an army, quite independently of whether they are or are not fighting under the command of a genius in two- or three-line formation, with cudgels or with rifles that repeat 30 times a minute. Men who want to fight will always put themselves in the most advantageous conditions for fighting. The spirit of an army is the factor which, multiplied by the mass, gives the resulting force. To define and express the significance of this unknown factor, the spirit of an army, is a problem for science. This problem is only solvable if we cease arbitrarily to substitute for the unknown X itself the conditions under which that force becomes apparent, such as the commands of the general, the equipment employed, and so on, mistaking these for the real significance of the factor. And if we recognize this unknown quantity in its entirety as being the greater or lesser desire to fight and to face danger. Only then, expressing known historic facts by equations and comparing the relative significance of this factor, can we hope to define the unknown. 10 men, battalions, or divisions, fighting 15 men, battalions, or divisions, conquer, that is, kill or take captive, all the others, while themselves losing 4. So that on the one side, 4, and on the other, 15 were lost. Consequently, the 4 were equal to the 15, and therefore 4x equals 15y. Consequently, x over y equals 15 over 4. This equation does not give us the value of the unknown factor, but gives us a ratio between two unknowns. And by bringing variously selected historic units, battles, campaigns, periods of war, into such equations, a series of numbers could be obtained in which certain laws should exist and might be discovered. The tactical rule that an army should act in masses when attacking and in smaller groups in retreat unconsciously confirms the truth that the strength of an army depends on its spirit. To lead men forward under fire, more discipline, obtainable only by movement in masses, is needed than is needed to resist attacks. But this rule, which leaves out of account the spirit of the army, continually proves incorrect, and is in particularly striking contrast to the facts when some strong rise or fall in the spirit of the troops occurs, as in all national wars. The French, retreating in 1812, though according to tactics they should have separated into detachments to defend themselves, congregated into a mass because the spirit of the army had so fallen that only the mass held the army together. The Russians, on the contrary, ought, according to tactics, to have attacked in mass, but in fact they split up into small units, because their spirit had so risen that separate individuals, without orders, dealt blows at the French without needing any compulsion to induce them to expose themselves to hardships and dangers. Chapter 2. The Partisans or Guerrillas. Denisov, Dolokhov, Petya Rostov, and Tikhon. a French drummer boy, a visit to the enemy's camp, attack on a French convoy, the death of Pecha. The so-called partisan war began with the entry of the French into Smolensk. Before partisan warfare had been officially recognized by the government, thousands of enemy stragglers, marauders, and foragers had been destroyed by the Cossacks and the peasants, who killed them off as instinctively as dogs worry a stray mad dog to death. Denis Davidov, with his Russian instinct, was the first to recognize the value of this terrible cudgel which, regardless of the rules of military science, destroyed the French. And to him belongs the credit for taking the first step toward regularizing this method of warfare. On August 24th, Davidov's first partisan detachment was formed, and then others were recognized. The further the campaign progressed, the more numerous these detachments became. The irregulars destroyed the great army piecemeal. They gathered the fallen leaves that dropped of themselves from that withered tree, the French army, and sometimes shook that tree itself. By October, when the French were fleeing toward Smolensk, there were hundreds of such companies of various sizes and characters. There were some that adopted all the army methods and had infantry, artillery, staffs, and the comforts of life. Others consisted solely of Cossack cavalry. There were also small scratch groups of foot and horse, and groups of peasants and landowners that remained unknown. A sacristan commanded one party which captured several hundred prisoners in the course of a month, and there was Vasilisa, the wife of a village elder who slew hundreds of the French. The partisan warfare flamed up most fiercely in the latter days of October. Its first period had passed, when the partisans themselves, amazed at their own boldness, feared every minute to be surrounded and captured by the French, and hid in the forests without unsaddling, hardly daring to dismount and always expecting to be pursued. By the end of October, this kind of warfare had taken definite shape. It had become clear to all what could be ventured against the French and what could not. Now, only the commanders of detachments with staffs and moving according to rules at a distance from the French still regarded many things as impossible. The small bands that had started their activities long before and had already observed the French closely considered things possible which the commanders of the big detachments did not dare to contemplate. The Cossacks and peasants who crept in among the French now considered everything possible. On October 22nd, Denisov, who was one of the irregulars, was with his group at the height of the guerrilla enthusiasm. Since early morning, he and his party had been on the move. All day long, he had been watching from the forest that skirted the high road a large French convoy of cavalry baggage and Russian prisoners separated from the rest of the army, which, as was learned from spies and prisoners, was moving under a strong escort to Smolensk. Besides Denisov and Dolokhov, who also led a small party and moved in Denisov's vicinity, the commanders of some large divisions with staffs also knew of this convoy, and, as Denisov expressed it, were sharpening their teeth for it. Two of the commanders of large parties, one a Pole and the other a German, sent invitations to Denisov almost simultaneously, requesting him to join up with their divisions to attack the convoy. "No bother. I have grown mustaches myself," said Denisov on reading these documents. And he wrote to the German that, despite his heartfelt desire to serve under so valiant and renowned a general, he had to forego that pleasure because he was already under the command of the Polish general. To the Polish general, he replied to the same effect, informing him that he was already under the command of the German. Having arranged matters thus, Denisov and Dolokhov intended, without reporting matters to the higher command, to attack and seize that convoy with their own small forces. On October 22nd, it was moving from the village of Mikulino to that of Shamshevo. To the left of the road between Mikulino and Shamshevo, there were large forests, extending in some places up to the road itself, though in others a mile or more back from it. Through these forests, Denisov and his party rode all day, sometimes keeping well back in them and sometimes coming to the very edge, but never losing sight of the moving French. That morning, Cossacks of Denisov's party had seized and carried off into the forest two wagons loaded with cavalry saddles, which had stuck in the mud not far from Mikulino, where the forest ran close to the road. Since then, and until evening, the party had watched the movements of the French without attacking. It was necessary to let the French reach Shamshevo quietly without alarming them, and then, after joining Dolokhov, who was to come that evening to a consultation at a watchman's hut in the forest less than a mile from Shamshevo, to surprise the French at dawn, falling like an avalanche on their heads from two sides, and rout and capture them all at one blow. In their rear, more than a mile from Mikulino, where the forest came right up to the road, six Cossacks were posted to report if any fresh columns of French should show themselves. Beyond Shamshevo, Dolokhov was to observe the road in the same way to find out at what distance there were other French troops. They reckoned that the convoy had 1,500 men. Denisov had 200, and Dolokhov might have as many more. But the disparity of numbers did not deter Denisov. All that he now wanted to know was what troops these were, and to learn that, he had to capture a tongue, that is, a man from the enemy column. That morning's attack on the wagons had been made so hastily that the Frenchmen with the wagons had all been killed. Only a little drummer boy had been taken alive, and as he was a straggler, he could tell them nothing definite about the troops in that column. Denisov considered it dangerous to make a second attack for fear of putting the whole column on the alert. So he sent Tikhon Shcherbaty, a peasant of his party, to Shamshevo to try and seize at least one of the French quartermasters who had been sent on in advance. It was a warm, rainy autumn day. The sky and the horizon were both the color of muddy water. At times a sort of mist descended, and then suddenly heavy, slanting rain came down. Denisov, in a felt cloak and a sheepskin cap from which the rain ran down, was riding a thin thoroughbred horse with sunken sides. Like his horse, which turned its head and laid its ears back, he shrank from the driving rain and gazed anxiously before him. His thin face, with its short, thick black beard, looked angry. Beside Denisov rode Enesaul, a captain of Cossacks, Denisov's fellow worker, also in felt cloak and sheepskin cap, and riding a large, sleek, don horse. Esaul Lovaisky III was a tall man as straight as an arrow, pale-faced, fair-haired, with narrow, light eyes, and with calm self-satisfaction in his face and bearing. Though it was impossible to say in what the peculiarity of the horse and rider lay, yet at first glance at the Esaul and Denisov, one saw that the latter was wet and uncomfortable and was a man mounted on a horse, while looking at the Esaul, one saw that he was as comfortable and as much at ease as always, and that he was not a man who had mounted a horse, but a man who was one with his horse, a being consequently possessed of twofold strength. A little ahead of them walked a peasant guide, wet to the skin, and wearing a gray peasant coat and a white knitted cap. A little behind, on a poor, small, lean Kyrgyz mount, with an enormous tail and mane and a bleeding mouth, rode a young officer in a blue French overcoat. Beside him rode an hussar, with a boy in a tattered French uniform and blue cap behind him on the crupper of his horse. The boy held on to the hussar with cold red hands, and raising his eyebrows, gazed about him with surprise. This was the French drummer boy captured that morning. Behind them, along the narrow, sodden, cut-up forest road, came hussars in threes and fours, and then Cossacks, some in felt cloaks, some in French greatcoats, and some with horse cloths over their heads. The horses, being drenched by the rain, all looked black, whether chestnut or bay. Their necks, with their wet, close-clinging manes, looked strangely thin. Steam rose from them. Clothes, saddles, reins were all wet, slippery, and sodden, like the ground and the fallen leaves that strewed the road. The men sat huddled up, trying not to stir so as to warm the water that had trickled to their bodies and not admit the fresh cold water that was leaking in under their seats, their knees, and at the back of their necks. In the midst of the outspread line of Cossacks, two wagons, drawn by French horses and by saddled Cossack horses that had been hitched on in front, rumbled over the tree stumps and branches and splashed through the water that lay in the ruts. Denisov's horse swerved aside to avoid a pool in the track and bumped his rider's knee against a tree.
"Oh, the devil!" exclaimed Denisov angrily,
and showing his teeth, he struck his horse three times with his whip, splashing himself and his comrades with mud. Denisov was out of sorts both because of the rain and also from hunger. None of them had eaten anything since morning. And yet more, because he still had no news from Dolokhov, and the man sent to capture a tongue had not yet returned.
There'll hardly be another such chance to fall on a transport as today. It's too risky to attack them by oneself, and if we put it off till another day, one of the big guerrilla detachments will snatch the prey from under our noses, thought Denisov, continually peering forward, hoping to see a messenger from Dolokhov.
On coming to a path in the forest, along which he could see far to the right, Denisov stopped.
"There's someone coming," said he.
The Esaul looked in the direction Denisov indicated.
"There are two, an officer and a Cossack. But it is not presupposable that it is the lieutenant colonel himself," said the Esaul, who was fond of using words the Cossacks did not know.
The approaching riders, having descended a decline, were no longer visible, but they reappeared a few minutes later. In front, at a weary gallop and using his leather whip, rode an officer, disheveled and drenched, whose trousers had worked up to above his knees. Behind him, standing in the stirrups, trotted a Cossack. The officer, a very young lad with a broad, rosy face and keen, merry eyes, galloped up to Denisov and handed him a sodden envelope.
"From the general," said the officer. "Please excuse its not being quite dry."
Denisov, frowning, took the envelope and opened it.
"There, they kept telling us, it's dangerous," said the officer, addressing the Saul while Denisov was reading the dispatch.
"But Komarov and I," he pointed to the Cossack, "were prepared. We have each of us two pistols."
"But what's this?" he asked, noticing the French drummer boy. "A prisoner? You've already been in action? May I speak to him?"
"Wostov! Petya!" exclaimed Denisov, having run through the dispatch. "Why didn't you say who you were?"
And turning with a smile, he held out his hand to the lad. The officer was Petya Rostov. All the way, Petya had been preparing himself to behave with Denisov as befitted a grown-up man and an officer, without hinting at their previous acquaintance. But as soon as Denisov smiled at him, Petya brightened up, blushed with pleasure, forgot the official manner he had been rehearsing, and began telling him how he had already been in a battle near Vyazma, and how a certain hussar had distinguished himself there.
"Well, I'm glad to see you," Denisov interrupted him,
and his face again assumed its anxious expression.
"Michael Feoklitich," said he to the Esaul, "this is again from that German, you know. He
indicated Petya, "is serving under him." And Denisov told the Esaul that the dispatch just delivered was a repetition of the German general's demand that he should join forces with him for an attack on the transport.
"If we don't take it tomorrow, he'll snatch it from under our noses," he added.
While Denisov was talking to the Esaul, Petya, abashed by Denisov's cold tone and supposing that it was due to the condition of his trousers, furtively tried to pull them down under his greatcoat so that no one should notice it, while maintaining as martial an air as possible.
"Will there be any orders, Your Honor?" he asked Denisov, holding his hand at the salute and resuming the game of adjutant and general for which he had prepared himself. "Or shall I remain with Your Honor?"
"Orders," Denisov repeated thoughtfully. "But can you stay till tomorrow?"
"Oh, please, may I stay with you?" cried Petya.
"But just what did the general tell you? To return at once?" asked Denisov.
Petya blushed. "He gave me no instructions. I think I could," he returned inquiringly.
"Well, all right," said Denisov.
And turning to his men, he directed a party to go on to the halting place arranged near the watchman's hut in the forest, and told the officer on the Kirghiz horse, who performed the duties of an adjutant, to go and find out where Dolokhov was and whether he would come that evening. Denisov himself intended going with the Esaul and Petya to the edge of the forest where it reached out to Shamshevo to have a look at the part of the French bivouac they were to attack next day.
"Well, old fellow," said he to the peasant guide,
Lead us to Shamshiro. Denisov, Pecha, and Isaul, accompanied by some Cossacks and the hussar who had the prisoner, rode to the left across a ravine to the edge of the forest. The rain had stopped, and only the mist was falling and drops from the trees. Denisov, Isaul, and Pecha rode silently, following the peasant in the knitted cap, who, stepping lightly with outturned toes and moving noiselessly in his bast shoes over the roots and wet leaves, silently led them to the edge of the forest. He ascended an incline, stopped, looked about him, and advanced to where the screen of trees was less dense. On reaching a large oak tree that had not yet shed its leaves, he stopped and beckoned mysteriously to them with his hand. Denisov and Petya rode up to him. From the spot where the peasant was standing, they could see the French. Immediately beyond the forest, on a downward slope, lay a field of spring rye. To the right, beyond a steep ravine, was a small village and a landowner's house with a broken roof. In the village, in the house, in the garden, by the well, by the pond, over all the rising ground, and all along the road uphill from the bridge leading to the village, not more than 500 yards away, crowds of men could be seen through the shimmering mist. Their un-Russian shouting at their horses, which were straining uphill with the carts, and their calls to one another could be clearly heard. "Bring the prisoner here," said Denisov in a low voice, not taking his eyes off the French. A Cossack dismounted, lifted the boy down, and took him to Denisov. Pointing to the French troops, Denisov asked him what these and those of them were. The boy, thrusting his cold hands into his pockets and lifting his eyebrows, looked at Denisov in a fright, but in spite of an evident desire to say all he knew, gave confused answers, merely assenting to everything Denisov asked him. Denisov turned away from him, frowning, and addressed the Isaul, conveying his own conjectures to him. Petya, rapidly turning his head, looked now at the drummer boy, now at Denisov, now at the Isaul, and now at the French in the village and along the road, trying not to miss anything of importance. "Whether Dolohov comes or not, we must seize it, eh?" said Denisov with a merry sparkle in his eyes. "It is a very suitable spot," said the Isaul. "We'll send the infantry down by the swamps," Denisov continued. "They'll creep up to the garden. You'll wind up from there with the Cossacks." He pointed to a spot in the forest beyond the village. "And I with my hussars from here. And at the signal shot..." "The hollow is impassable. There's a swamp there," said the Isaul. "The horses would sink. We must ride round more to the left." While they were talking in undertones, the crack of a shot sounded from the low ground by the pond. A puff of white smoke appeared, then another, and the sound of hundreds of seemingly merry French voices shouting together came up from the slope. For a moment, Denisov and the Isaul drew back. They were so near that they thought they were the cause of the firing and shouting. But the firing and shouting did not relate to them. Down below, a man wearing something red was running through the marsh. The French were evidently firing and shouting at him. "Why, that's our Tichon," said the Isaul.
"So it is, so it is." "The rascal," said Denisov.
"He'll get away," said the Isaul, screwing up his eyes. The man whom they called Tichon, having run to the stream, plunged in so that the water splashed in the air, and, having disappeared for an instant, scrambled out on all fours, all black with the wet, and ran on. The French who had been pursuing him stopped.
"Smart, that," said the Isaul. "What a beast," said Denisov with his former look of vexation. "What has he been doing all this time?"
"Who is he?" asked Petya.
"He's our Plastun. I sent him to capture a tongue."
Plastun is an unmounted sharpshooter among the Black Sea Cossacks. "Oh, yes," said Petya, nodding at the first words Denisov uttered as if he understood it all, though he really did not understand anything of it. "Tichon Shcherbaty was one of the most indispensable men in their band. He was a peasant from Pokrovsk, near the river Gzhat. When Denisov had come to Pokrovsk at the beginning of his operations, and had as usual summoned the village elder and asked him what he knew about the French, the elder, as though shielding himself, had replied, as all village elders did, that he had neither seen nor heard anything of them. But when Denisov explained that his purpose was to kill the French, and asked if no French had strayed that way, the elder replied that some more orderers had really been at their village, but that Tihon Shcherbati was the only man who dealt with such matters. Denisov had Tihon called, and having praised him for his activity, said a few words in the elder's presence about loyalty to the Tsar and the country, and the hatred of the French that all sons of the fatherland should cherish. "We don't do the French any harm," said Tihon, evidently frightened by Denisov's words. "We only fooled about with the lads for fun, you know. We killed a score or so of more orderers, but we did no harm else." Next day, when Denisov had left Pokrovsk, having quite forgotten about this peasant, it was reported to him that Tihon had attached himself to their party and asked to be allowed to remain with it. Denisov gave orders to let him do so. Tihon, who at first did rough work, laying camp fires, fetching water, flaying dead horses, and so on, soon showed a great liking and aptitude for partisan warfare. At night he would go out for booty, and always brought back French clothing and weapons, and when told to, would bring in French captives also. Denisov then relieved him from drudgery and began taking him with him when he went out on expeditions, and had him enrolled among the Cossacks. Tihon did not like riding, and always went on foot, never lagging behind the cavalry. He was armed with a musketoon, which he carried rather as a joke, a pike and an axe, which latter he used as a wolf uses its teeth, with equal ease picking fleas out of its fur or crunching thick bones. Tihon, with equal accuracy, would split logs with blows at arm's length, or, holding the head of the axe, would cut thin little pegs or carve spoons. In Denisov's party, he held a peculiar and exceptional position. When anything particularly difficult or nasty had to be done, to push a cart out of the mud with one's shoulders, pull a horse out of a swamp by its tail, skin it, slink in among the French, or walk more than 30 miles in a day, everybody pointed laughingly at Tihon.